Hi, this is Nancy from the Canary. Before we get into this week's Canary Pod, I wanted to say a few words. Our recording session this week happened before the terrible attack in the Borough area of London on the evening of Saturday the 3rd of June. We're sorry we've not had a chance to fully acknowledge those who were injured or lost their lives, or indeed the brave emergency service personnel who attended the scene. Our thoughts are with everyone affected at this time. We're about to look at just two of the extraordinary debates that were broadcast this week. So without further ado, over to Kerri-Anne.
Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind The Canary, Britain's leading independent news site. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza, The Canary's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Each week, we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days. Today, it's the leadership debate debrief. This week, we had two different styles of TV debate. Channel 4 and Sky News put on the battle for number 10, where Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn were grilled first by a studio audience and then by Jeremy Paxman. On Wednesday night, we had the big BBC debate. The leaders of the Green Party, Liberal Democrats, UKIP, Plaid Cymru and Labour were present for the debate. The SNP sent Deputy Leader Angus Robertson and the Conservatives sent Home Secretary Amber Rudd because Theresa May refuses to participate in the TV debate. Here to discuss the issues and the key moments from those events, we have the Canary's Discovery editor, John Ranson, and Weekend editor, Emily Apple. Welcome, team.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. And I should just say for our listeners at home or wherever you're listening to the podcast, my voice may sound a bit croaky this morning. I'm battling a bit of a hay fever fit. So I apologise for any inadvertently poor noises that come out of me today. You can be assured that our podcast producers, Nancy and Mia, will be working overtime to remove all of my various coughs and splutters. But if they miss some, know that they worked valiantly. Okay, so guys, shall we start with the battle for number 10? Which took place on Channel 4, tag-teamed with Sky News earlier this week. And we'll go over to John now to see his take on the battle for number 10. John, were there any moments that particularly stuck out for you?
Well, yes, I think the issue of leaders versus manifestos, the Conservatives have tried from the outset to turn this into a presidential style face-off between Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn. And that continued really with the Paxman interviews on Monday night, where he started out with Corbyn saying, so, you know, these are your personal views and they're not in the manifesto. You know, what's going on with that? How can you be a leader if you can't even get your ideas into the manifesto?
Yeah.
And Corbyn very, you know, calmly and clearly pointed out that it's a manifesto which represents the entire Labour Party. It's quite an extraordinary achievement in many ways to actually get anything unified out of the Labour Party with the, you know, so some of the troubles that they've had with various kind of restive elements within the party. But they produced this manifesto, which I think everybody, you know, has looked at apart from the most ardent Tory and has said, gosh, you know, this really is an extraordinary document, an incredible balancing act, if you like, between ambition and common sense, which really does lay out a positive blueprint for the country. And so Corbyn made the point that it's a manifesto that belongs to the whole party. Yeah. And that as a leader, he accepts that there may be things that he personally would have liked to have been in there, but which aren't in there, but it's a manifesto for the whole party. He's the leader of the party and he will stand on that manifesto. And he made the simple point. He said, I'm fighting this election on social justice.
Yeah.
And the way his eyes, I wouldn't say they lit up, they burned. Yeah. You know, with kind of righteous fire when he said that particular comment.
Yeah.
You could tell he really meant it. And you could tell that he's proud of this manifesto because, you know, forget the fact that there may be one or two things that in a dream world he could have put in there.
Yeah.
This is a manifesto that he's incredibly proud of, and he's very happy to take to the country and to stand on it, because it, taken as a whole, it sums up, you know, his ambition for social justice, for a more equal society.
Absolutely. And if listeners want to hear our views on the detail of that manifesto, we do actually have an earlier episode of the podcast entitled Battle of the Manifestos, so you can go and find out all of the detail there. We won't rehearse it on this episode. Emily, what were your key moments from the battle for number 10?
I think for me, it was the times that Theresa May actually has to face real people and the problems that she's caused for them. So for me, one of the most moving moments was when she was confronted by a midwife talking about the cuts to services. And all Theresa May can say is that she wants a first-class NHS, but to do so, she needs a really strong economy. Yeah. But what's she been doing since 2010? And what have the Tories been doing since 2010? And when the midwife came back to her, you could hear the emotion in her voice when she was talking about cuts, about hospitals closing, about staffs being at their wits' ends. And the problem for Theresa May is this is all borne out in the figures. The Royal College of Midwives have said in the last year that 38.6% of units have had to close at some point temporarily. A fifth of those budget cuts, 13.6% have had to reduce staffing and services. So these are essential services around midwifery, sometimes around things like perinatal mental health, around breastfeeding, and really essential services that are being cut. So every time she actually has to talk to people, she's confronted with the reality of what her government has done, and she can't spin that.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly, you know, looking at the sort of social media responses that were happening while the debate was happening, and certainly, you know, that whole moment between the midwife and Theresa May was really powerful. And it did feel almost like Theresa May was almost right to stay away from the public as much as possible, in the sense that, as you say, anytime she's actually presented with the public, you know, her record is indefensible on these issues.
Oh, no, it was like when she met the woman who was confronting her over what the government's doing with learning disabilities and what they've done to benefits. And every single time, yes, there is nothing she can say, because her record speaks for itself, and ordinary people that she meets have been at the end of what they've done. So it's very clear why she's avoiding real people and why she avoided the other debate as well, because she's got no answers, and she can repeat, oh, strong economy, Brexit, repeatedly, but it's meaningless.
Absolutely. I think one of the moments, I'm sure you'd pick up on this as well, was when she was confronted with that question by the serving police officer. Mm. You know, and what I found astonishing about this, because she repeated it several times on and off air. Amber Rudd did the same in the BBC debate that we'll come to later, is she just flat out lies. Yeah. you're there in front of a serving police officer saying, hey, what about these cuts of 20,000 police officers? And Theresa May saying the budget is protected. We know the budget isn't protected, because we've seen the cuts that have been made. We've seen the, you know, 17.6% cut in serving police officers. We've seen armed police officers halved. We've had the footage of her at the Police Federation over 2 years ago, being warned by the police officers that these cuts would have a detrimental effect on security. Even Great Manchester Police in the room saying, you know, information on, you know, terrorist threats and other security issues had basically run dry because they were no longer capable of providing the resources to, you know, make those relationships in communities where you might get a hold of that information. So these are really, really serious issues, and they're indisputable facts. And then presented with them by a member of the public, instead of, you know, I would almost have more respect for her if she said, yes, we did cut it, this is why. But she didn't. She continues to assert that no cuts have taken place. I mean, what do you think the impact of that is going to be on, you know, police officers, nurses and public sector workers and the people who depend on them across the country, to see this night and day difference between, you know, the real world and Theresa May's version of the world?
Well, Well, it's got to have an impact. I mean, it's the same in education. They keep saying there haven't been cuts. And 3,000 schools have written to parents detailing the impact of cuts. So people know what is happening. They know what is happening to our services. And to see politicians telling barefaced lies about them doesn't do anyone any favours. And it doesn't do the world of politics any favours at all. But actually, in some ways, you know, where Jeremy Corbyn through is with that integrity and actually doing something different and not spinning things and not giving figures when he doesn't know a figure or where he can't promise a figure. And I think that does have an impact on people at home because they are seeing that things can be done differently and that we don't have to just listen to these sound bites and these lies. And anyone who's had contact with the NHS, who knows people have used it, anyone who's got children at school, anyone who's in the police force, we all know what this government has done. Anyone who's received benefits, who've had disability benefits cuts, who've had their mobility card taken away, it's there for all of us to see. So it's not like she's got anywhere to hide with it because it's so far reaching, you know, in terms of what she's doing, it is so far reaching that so many people have been affected by it.
Absolutely. I also found it quite rich for her to be talking about, you know, her willingness to make, quote, difficult decisions. You know, as far as most people would be concerned, it's not a difficult decision. It's not actually difficult to take from those with the least, you know, to take from the most vulnerable and disempowered members of our society. It is a very difficult task to take on vested interests and powerful communities in this country. And the Conservative Party have manifestly failed, you know, to do that. And we'll come more to that more later in the programme. Emily, any other standout moments from the battle for number 10 from you before we move to John?
I think for me, it was sort of Corbyn's humour and his patience. I was so impressed with how he came across when he was talking about the abolition of the monarchy, and he was just like, well, you know, it's not there because we're not going to do it. You know, and I read a tweet afterwards, you know, that sort of summed it up. It was kind of like, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, did you believe in Santa Claus when you were nine? Why isn't that in the manifesto? You know, just sort of summed it up. But he dealt with it with immense dignity and patience and humour, and actually surprised me how well he came across.
Yeah, I think that's certainly been borne out by a lot of the reaction that we've seen from people. I mean, I've literally lost count of the emails and the phone calls and the tweets that I've had from people who've said, oh, you know, I this guy that I'm seeing tonight is not the guy that I was told existed. You know, I've been given this image of Jeremy Corbyn, you know, as this kind of, you know, uncharismatic, you know, sort of pencil pusher type of chap. And, you know, and then actually seeing him with no filter, you know, just actually seeing him kind of be himself and present his ideas. I think that's basically, I think a lot of the people that were really ecstatic when Jeremy became leader of the Labour Party, because they knew the man, you know, they knew that this was, you know, someone with integrity, someone with huge personal charisma, actually, and just a generally decent bloke. To actually see other people encounter him and have that same response, I think would have been immensely satisfying, you know, for those people that have been pushing, you know, for the last year or two to say, you've got to give this guy a fair shake of the stick.
Oh, absolutely. And I've kind of noticed that there's been a drop off in this kind of, oh, weak and useless leader thing, because people can see that he's not. He's shown real leadership with these debates.
Yeah.
It's become much of less of a stick to beat him with, which is fantastic, because people are actually getting that message, and they, as you say, they're getting it unfiltered, which is something we've been arguing about for a long time. It is that constant spin that's put on the way that he's presented is what has that detrimental effect, rather than people looking at the man, at the party and at the policies and making decisions based on those things.
Anything else, John, that stood out for you in that debate?
Well, another element where, again, I think Paxman was trying to sort of play up to the agenda of personalities. And so he was digging back into that old comment about Corbyn supposedly calling Hamas his friends.
Yeah.
which I think, you know, anybody who's looked into it will completely understand that the phrase "our friends from Hamas," you know, it's a simple use of words that one would use when, you know, referring to people who are present at a meeting, in the same way that, you know, somebody might have referred to Paul Nuttall during the debate last night. They might have said, "our friend from UKIP."
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't mean they're his best
literal
buddy.
Literal friends.
Absolutely. And the way Paxman kind of drove this, he obviously thought he was onto something, but he ended up sitting there all scrunched up in a ball with his arms folded, looking utterly petulant and childish, and saying, "but you said they were your friends."
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, I haven't heard anybody say that since I was about six and there was an argument over who was in whose gang in the playground. And, you know, Corbyn just said, "look, it was inclusive language."
Yeah. And it was, you know, I mean, that's part of the thing as well, is that, there has to be a distinction between the way, you know, members of the public might speak about different groups and individuals having a pint in the pub, and the language that needs to be used by people who are actually going to have to sit around a table with these people and negotiate peace treaties. The likes of Jeremy Corbyn don't actually get the privilege of indulging, you know, their personal feelings and their personal kind of animosities towards any group, because ultimately their responsibility is so much greater. You know, they actually have to be able to somehow take these fragmented interest groups and bring them together in the name of peace. And you can't do that when you're busy kind of nurturing your pet hatreds, you know, and your personal feelings on the matter. And that's what I think made the question additionally absurd, actually.
Yeah. There was such a contrast. Corbyn also said he meets, you know, all kinds of people, many of whom he doesn't necessarily agree with.
Yeah.
But he says he always finds something to learn when he meets someone. And he finished by saying that leadership is as much about, and he pointed to his ear, as it is about, and he pointed to his mouth, you know, making the point that good leadership is about listening, as well as it is about speaking. And that contrasted very strongly with certainly the body language of Theresa May, who seemed to bridle and kind of flinch whenever she felt questioned, and whenever she felt that people were disagreeing with her. She seemed to, as I say, you know, she seemed to flinch as if she were saying, "how dare you disagree with me? Don't you know who I am?"
I don't know. Did you guys actually pick up on the facial tic? I think we might have actually learned Theresa May's facial tic, which actually is a giveaway when she's being a little bit inauthentic. She does this each of her lips sort of point to the south, so she ends up sort of gurning briefly. And I was actually watching the debate and noticing there was a natural lineup between this weird sort of facial expression and where she's being inauthentic.
It's certainly fair to say that in body language terms, Jeremy Corbyn came across much better.
Yeah.
He appeared very comfortable in his surroundings. He was happy to be questioned. You know, he was happy to be quizzed on his personal positions. Whereas, as I say, May seemed like she just wanted to sort of spout her thing and didn't like anybody taking issue with her.
Throughout her whole appearance, she just seemed nervous and she seemed anxious.
Mm.
I see that in her body language, and it just wasn't a good look for somebody who's projecting themselves throughout this entire election campaign as a strong and stable leader.
Yeah.
She seemed far from it. She didn't want to be there, and everything about her exuded that.
Okay, that seems like the natural place to move on from the battle for number 10. We're going to discuss the BBC debate shortly, but before we do that, I'm just going to hand you over to Nancy, who's going to tell you how to get in touch with us at Canary Pod, and also some exciting news about a new membership scheme that we're just launching at the Canary.
Hello. If you'd like to get in touch, please tweet at Canary Pod, or email podcast@thecanary.co. And if you're enjoying Canary Pod, please rate, review and share on your favourite podcast platform. Finally, there's a new way to support the work that we do at The Canary. You can now become a member and receive some exciting benefits in return for a monthly subscription. please go to www.thecanary.co/membership for more information on how you can support fearless, independent journalism. Thanks.
Okay, you're back with us at Canary Pod. We're discussing the leadership debate debrief. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza. Right, guys, the BBC debates. Wow.
Yeah.
That was a pretty extraordinary night we had on Wednesday. John, what was your take on Wednesday night?
I think the highlight of the night was undoubtedly the Magic Money Tree drinking game. And the use of that phrase didn't just come from Amber Rudd, who was there coming off the bench for Theresa May, who seemed to be unable or unwilling to turn up. And what was really shocking was the way the phrase was not just used by Amber Rudd, but was then parroted. Certainly I saw it from Vicky Young, the BBC's political correspondent.
Yeah.
And she was rehashing at the end, talking about Amber Rudd's comments. And she said her argument in defence of that, talking about the Conservatives' record on various things, was that you have to make difficult decisions when you're in power. We've already mentioned that, you know, yep. How difficult can it be to make a decision about is it okay to put people into absolute poverty? And she turned that back on the Labour Party, so says Vicky Young, saying about Jeremy Corbyn, you are promising to put up people's taxes, you are promising to borrow more, you just want to spend, and it's a magic money tree.
Yeah.
So there she's quoting Amber Rudd. Then she goes into her own thing and says, that argument was central tonight, the economy. And I was just staggered. I thought, how can, obviously, a serious and experienced journalist be effectively using the magic money tree argument on behalf of the Tories and presenting that as if that is the argument on the economy.
Well, actually,
it made absolutely no sense.
It really
to
didn't.
Me.
I mean, I was taken aback. I mean, obviously, we were covering the debate live, so we were responding pretty much immediately to events as they happened. And I put out a story last night, which was basically, this is how many times Amber Rudd lied in the opening 34 seconds. Of the debate, you know, her opening gambit was just 34 seconds. And I caught, what was it, four or five quite profound lies. You know, it's strong language, but it's also true. You know, and this was one of them, this magic money tree. You know, Labour has a fully costed manifesto. The full annual cost of what they're proposing is around £48.6 billion a year. And that is about half what the Conservative government is currently using taxpayer money to provide handouts to corporations each year. So currently, the cost of taxpayer handouts to private corporations in this country is £93 billion a year. This was incredible research that was done by a team at The Guardian. It's been widely reported, so you can go out and check those figures for yourself. You know, so this is not about a magic money tree. You know, this is about taking half of the corporate welfare, it's, you know, half of the money from the corporate welfare system and saying, hey, guys, how about a rejig? And we move that into the people welfare system, you know, that's going to benefit people relying on the NHS, our education system, our transport system, our housing, you know, all of these services upon which most of us rely. And you still, it's not like we've even dismantled the entirety of the corporate welfare state. They're still going to have about £40 billion a year. You know, they're not completely cap in hand at the end of this. I found it staggering that nobody brought this up. None of the journalists in that room, when they were speaking to Conservative representatives, you know, after the debate, addressed this issue and said, hang on a minute, firstly, Labour have costed their manifesto and you haven't. And secondly, we're only talking about a redistribution of the welfare, the money that we spend on welfare from corporations to people and our public services, not creating new money out of nowhere.
Yeah, no, I mean, the entire argument, as I see it, is wrong for two fundamental reasons. The first one is in terms of making choices, and the fact that the phrase magic money tree is invoked when we're talking about paying disability allowance or personal independent payments, that kind of thing. When we're talking about working tax credits for people on poverty wages, and when we're talking about, you know, even things like tuition fees for university students. Oh, no, you can't do that. You know, it's a magic money tree, blah, blah, blah. And yet, when it comes to renewing Trident or it comes to joining in with an airstrike on some unfortunate country somewhere, then suddenly there's not the slightest talk of, you know, of expense or how much is this going to cost or where's the money going to come from. It's, oh, no, this is something we've got to do. You know, when it came to quantitative easing and bailing out the banks, you know, hundreds of billions of pounds that was sort of spirited up from nowhere, pretty much. And then, you know, nobody said, oh, well, you can't do that unless you've got a magic money tree in your back garden. It was, no, these are the decisions that government has to take. But so it's completely like one rule for one situation and a totally different rule for another situation. But the other absolutely fundamental error with it is it completely misunderstands how a national economy works.
Yeah.
It takes the view that the moment you spend some money on something like a free school meal for a child, that money is gone and it's never going to come back ever again. and it doesn't take into account the fact that if you pay for a child's school meal, the child's parents don't have to pay for the school meal. Yeah. So they are probably, in all likelihood, going to spend the £3 or whatever it is, certainly not 6.8 pence, thank you very much, Theresa May.
Yeah.
They're going to spend that money on something else. They're going to spend it in a local shop. Maybe they're going to spend it in a supermarket. Who knows? They're going to spend it somewhere. It's going to go into the economy, and this money then begins to circulate.
Yeah.
And what the Tories have done with their nonsensical austerity regime is to strangle the economy by basically kind of saying, if we all stand still, absolutely still as statues, then maybe everything will be okay. And all that happens is everybody gets cramp. The whole thing grinds to a halt. And you end up with an economy that's just not functioning properly unless you happen to be a Qatari property investor or someone with all their money in the Cayman Islands. It's just not working. Whereas the Labour proposals, to my mind, they point to a future of the country in which money is actually circulating again. People are earning money and people are spending money. Because at the moment, people are terrified to spend money because they know that every penny counts.
Yeah.
They've been tightening their belt for 7 years because they've been told they've got to. Most people's belts are so tight that, you know, they're practically joining in the middle. And, you know, it's just strangling the economy.
So obviously, you know, you're absolutely right, John. The Conservatives keep banging on with this misleading image of the economy as if it's a household budget. And actually, I find a far more realistic, still imperfect, but a far more realistic analogy to use would be, it's not a household budget, it's more like a street with a market at the end of it. And and so the people in the houses are not only customers of that market, but all of their employment rests on that market too. So they're the business owners, they're the stallholders in that market. So what the government is saying is just focusing on the households and saying, right, you all need to stop shopping so much and we need to raise the prices at this market at the bottom of the street. And then what you have is you might have, as a, you know, you're benefiting in the house individually saying, oh, yes, I spent, you know, £50 less at the market this week, but your stall's just gone out of business because so did everybody else in the street and you've now got no customers at the market. And I think this is the fundamental misunderstanding of that whole austerity mindset. And this isn't just our opinion. There are countless studies put forward by economists across the country and the world that advocate for this position that, you know, if you don't invest in your economy, if you don't create jobs with living wages, which mean people, you're actually elevating the income levels of housing, you lose. You lose as a country. And we keep, you know, referring to this on the podcast, but we don't have a national economy in Britain anymore. Part of the impact of the policies of austerity have been to essentially create an apartheid economics, where you now have 12 regional economies in Britain rather than one. So you have this overall figure that the government comes out with and says we have 0.0001% growth this month. You know, haven't we done a fantastic job in terms of the economy? When you actually drill down deeper in the numbers and you can see these figures the ONS, the Office of National Statistics figures on our website. Essentially, only two of these regional economies is as well off or better off than they were before the financial crisis of 2007-08. And they will be no surprise to you whatsoever. London and the South East. Every single other region of the UK is poorer than it was in 2007. That is a decade after the financial crisis. You know, 7 years of this austerity economics. And some of those regions, you know, Northern Ireland, Yorkshire and the Humber, are actually in depression. So you've got people all over the country. The reason, you know, many of you listening now might have been thinking over the past few years, I don't get it. The government's telling me the economy's growing. My economy isn't growing. You know, my living standards aren't going up. You know, I feel significantly poorer than I did 10 years ago. Well, this is the reason why, because you actually are poorer probably than you were 10 years ago. And I think it just goes back to your point exactly, John, which is about the absolutely galling misrepresentation of economic issues, not only by the government, but by some of the media outlets that are supposed to be serving, you know, as the fourth estate and asking these questions and putting these issues to the politicians who are doing that misrepresenting.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the Conservative Party is showing complete contempt for the electorate. They're using these ridiculously simplistic slogans, and yet they're also flip-flopping. So one minute they say, we've created a strong economy. The next moment they say, unless we create a strong economy, we won't be able to invest in the NHS, or we won't be able to run schools with class sizes of less than 40, yeah, or whatever it happens to be. And they want us to believe two completely contradictory things simultaneously. Mm. You know, one is that the country is in an absolute hole and only the Conservative Party can drag it out of that hole. And then at the same time, they want us to believe that the country isn't in a hole in the slightest, because after 7 years of Conservative government, we're better than we've ever been.
Yeah.
And there's no way that both those two things can be true.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, we ought to treat their comments with the contempt that they deserve and utterly reject them, because it just doesn't make any sense at all.
Absolutely. I guess we'll wait to see on the 8th of June if that's an offer that the British public take up. Okay, John, any other key points from the BBC debate that you want to mention?
I think the other point about treating the electorate with contempt, which, as Tim Farron said in the BBC debate, hung like a shadow over the entire debate, was the simple fact that Theresa May wasn't there.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we've already kind of suggested, you know, maybe it was good for her that she wasn't there, because she's so utterly rubbish whenever she does anything that isn't a stage managed appearance in an empty factory. And I think that she would have floundered pretty badly. I think, to be honest, Amber Rudd did a better job than Theresa May would have done.
Yeah.
She came across as ever so slightly more human. And, you know, she did her best given the absolute hospital pass that she'd been given by Theresa May.
Yeah.
You know, Caroline Lucas said one of the most important aspects of leadership is to show up.
Quite.
And, you know, so very, very true. And, you know, as I say, Tim Farron said that her absence hung like a shadow. You know, he said that she couldn't be bothered to face the public.
Yeah.
And I think it also showed that there is the possibility of a genuine anti-Tory coalition.
Yeah.
With the exception of Paul Nuttall of UKIP, who in the BBC debate on Wednesday night seemed to be kind of oscillating in his own private little universe. It almost seems slightly unclear why he was there.
Yeah.
The others were giving a united front against the Conservative mismanagement of the country. And I do think there is a real possibility that we could see a different kind of politics in Britain, where parties who are in broad agreement on many issues especially on the issue of austerity and the fact that it's a totally bogus direction for the country to go in, that they could actually come together and combine their strengths. And certainly, you know, last night with the contributions, particularly of Caroline Lucas, who seemed to come out as number one in pretty much everybody's kind of ranking list of the contributors. You know, there's a real possibility that these people can contribute, you know, even to the government of the country. And Paul Mason has written a piece in which he actually envisages a kind of multi-party cabinet situation. And I think far from being what the Conservatives have attempted to portray as a coalition of chaos, I think you've actually got a coalition of common sense standing against the complete nonsense on stilts that keeps coming out of the Conservative Party. And I think ultimately, you know, this election deserves to be won on policies, not on personalities. The Conservatives have tried to turn it into a presidential runoff, and they've abjectly failed because it's turned out that their personality actually hasn't got a personality and isn't up to being an effective leader. Jeremy Corbyn has led the way on policies, and it's quite clear that many of the other parties would have something to contribute. And it would be a jolly sight better than anything that we've seen from the Conservatives or that we can expect from them in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I think the Conservatives are way off on the public pulse, actually, on this particular issue as well, because for most people, having watched the BBC debate on Wednesday night, but also just the, you know, watching politics evolve over the last decade, you know, this would all has the potential to be, you know, a real dream team of a cabinet. You know, if you were actually, you know, potentially having influences from other parties, you know, that broader base of views, and in terms of, you know, the electorate being better represented in number 10, it would be extraordinary.
Yeah, completely.
And, you know, and move us away from that, you know, this consistently adversarial politics into something a bit more cooperative, you know, in terms of this progressive alliance. So, yeah, fantastic, John. Thank you for those really, really brilliant points that you've brought up there. And now we'll go over to Emily. Emily, your key moments from the BBC debate.
I think I've got to start off just by saying that Corbyn played an absolute blinder in his last decision, because he put Theresa May in an impossible position, and he totally rejigged both the leadership debate and the media debate and refocused it. He just sort of knocked everything out with that. And I thought that was fantastic. I thought that was such a good move in an election campaign. And you could just see it in May's response. She just knows she's been played on that one. And I also thought he did really well when he got there, especially when he was talking about food banks. I thought, for example, he was so strong. I think John was saying earlier about the passion and the fire in his eyes.
Yeah.
And you can just see that he means it and that he feels it. And, you know, he was talking about putting up corporation tax to deal with the NHS, to deal with this crisis in social care.
Yeah.
Asking Amber Rudd if she'd been to a food bank, if she'd seen the poverty that exists, that the people are home, you know, the number of people sleeping rough. And again, you know, it's back to the points I was making earlier. There is so much information out there about what the Tories have done. There's sort of no sort of answers. According to the Trussell Trust, from the 1st of April 2016 until the 31st of March 2017, they gave out 1,182,000 food parcels for three-day emergency supplies. And amongst that included food parcels for 456,000 children. They also found that since the introduction of universal credit, which is another of the Tories' flagship policies to unify benefits, there'd been a 16.85% increase in referrals, partly due to the increase in sort of 6+ week waiting period, but also to do with factors to do with actually getting the benefits, the online system for applying for it. So again, these are real numbers. These are real people who are suffering. And that's what came across in Jeremy Corbyn's question.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think, slightly tangential issue, but because if anyone's watching EastEnders at the moment, It's an absolutely incredible storyline, especially given it's in the run-up to a general election, where actually one of the characters has become unemployed, a character called Denise Fox. She's become unemployed and she's not eaten for several days because she literally has no money. And then she finally gets to the point where she's approved for the benefit and they say, but actually, we're ever so sorry, Mrs. Fox. But because you technically left your last job voluntarily, despite the fact that she was bullied out, by the by, you've been sanctioned. So you can't claim for another 12 weeks. And it is just the most devastating storyline. And it is bringing to life, you know, as Ken Loach's film, you know, I, Daniel Blake did, this is life in Britain for a lot of people today.
This is it. It has just become so extraordinarily difficult. There is no lifeline anymore, and it is absolutely terrifying. These are people in desperate need. And people who are just, you know, it feels like, you know, it's some dystopian nightmare. And the thing that struck me about I, Daniel Blake, you know, it's even down to the music that they had on hold is the music that they use at the benefit centre when they put you on hold. And it is, it just feels so, oh, it's just awful. And for all the detractors who are saying, oh, well, this doesn't really happen. It does really happen. And it doesn't take much research or much talking to people. You know, go to your local shop and talk to people. You will meet someone who's been screwed over by the system. I was out, you know, another tangential thing, you know, I was out at the weekend and I was talking to a woman whose son has muscular dystrophy. And she was just telling me, we just happened to be talking, we were queuing up for something. And she just randomly happened to tell me all the problems she'd had getting her son's benefits sorted, all the appeals that she had to go to and where they were now and how exhausting it all is. And you know, it's just there for everyone to see what they've done.
It does. I mean, it frankly just makes me ashamed sometimes. Really, you know, I look at it and I just think, we're the sixth wealthiest country in the world. This is not an economic necessity. This is a choice. This is a political choice that has, you know, driven hundreds of thousands of people into not just poverty, but abject poverty and destitution. And I think to be Theresa May, to be David Cameron, to be the people that have participated in this, I mean, how do you even sleep at night? I really don't know. Okay, so that seems like a neat place to wrap up this week's episode of Canary Pod. To be honest, we could continue chatting about this infinitely, I think, because the number of issues that were covered this week were vast. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of evidence to discuss behind those issues too. But we do have to stop at some point. Obviously, you listeners have lives to lead to. So we're going to stop here. Just before we do go, though, just have final thoughts from both of you, beginning with Emily.
I think really what this has shown is how little the Tories have got to offer us. We know that they're just sound bites, but to have it sort of drilled in over those two debates, they've got the magic money tree, they've got Brexit, they've got strong and stable, but they've got no real policies that they actually want to talk about. And the only ones that they do are complete disasters, like the dementia tax. And there is absolutely no way that you can trust this party that has done so much damage and done so many U-turns. And I think this has come across through these debates because they've got no answers for anything. And as we were saying earlier, to have a party that just wants to keep patronising us and teaching us, treating us with contempt is just disgusting. And I really, really, really just hope that people respond to that and go, no, I'm fed up with being patronised. I'm fed up with being told I can't have this while the rich's top 5% have so much, and that we're going to change this.
Brilliant. That's great. Thank you for that, Emily. And John, your final thoughts.
The Conservative Party are treating us with absolute contempt. They talk about how, you know, we should put all our efforts into obtaining a strong Brexit and that kind of thing, and sort of taking back control of our country. And yet, they've now put all their election hopes effectively into the hands of two Australians, their election campaign strategist, Lynton Crosby, who now has sole charge of their campaign. And of course, their tame media man, Rupert Murdoch, who will no doubt be doing his level best over the final week to make the Tories look as good as he can. But failing that, because that might be a task even beyond his considerable skills, to make Corbyn look as bad as he can.
Yep.
That will be what they're doing. The whole plan for the election campaign has been to try and put the focus onto Jeremy Corbyn and to scare people into not voting in a way which would allow Corbyn to become Prime Minister. Meanwhile, Jeremy Corbyn has focused on what it actually takes to make this country a better place. He's put his efforts and his passion quite clearly into a manifesto for social justice and a manifesto for change, a manifesto for reducing the inequality that's so blatantly running out of control in our society. And so ultimately, that'll be the choice. You know, do we want to vote for a party which is run by and for the very wealthy, the expat Australians, the people of questionable tax status, or do we want to put it into a people-powered movement that is aiming to create a country that works for the many and not for the few? It's, to my mind, it's an incredibly simple choice. It's the choice that the country will have on Thursday, the 8th of June. And I think personally that the Labour Party has given the country every reason that it needs to reject the Tories and to go off in a much better direction for everybody.
Well, we're going to find out on the 8th of June what the British public choose. But certainly for the first time in very, very many general elections, we do have a night and day choice. A real genuine choice to make on June the 8th. More of the same, more austerity, more food banks, more cuts to public services, more privatisations, less control from communities, more control consolidated in the vested interests and the powerful in this country. Or we can vote for hope, and we can vote for change, and we can vote to take that control back. I know what I'm going to do on June the 8th, but your choice is your own. Thanks for joining us today at Canary Pod. And thanks to the Canaries who joined me today, Emily Apple and John Ranson. And we're just wishing you a really, really great week ahead. And as we always say, don't get angry, get involved.